This is Ridiculous History, a show based in Atlanta, a city that loves brunch. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. Hi, my name is Ben.
My name is Noel, and Ben, egg me up before you go-go.
There we go. Lego my egg-go.
Give me back my eggs.
Yes, okay. Well, after the show—
You'll pry these eggs from my cold, dead hands.
Eggs, right? When you think of brunch or when you think of breakfast, you typically think of a few things. And one of the main stars of the breakfast pantheon is going to be the humble, ubiquitous egg. Are you an egg fan?
Benedict, Florentine, omelet, scrambled. I'm a poached egg fan of recent times. And I like a good old boiled egg myself. So, yes, I am an egg enthusiast.
You're an egg enthusiast, Noel. Earlier, before we hopped on air for this episode, we were talking about the type of food preparation known as deviling, right?
You were.
And we had to look it up because it's strange when you think of deviled eggs or deviled ham. And there's a curious story for that, but that is not the subject of today's episode. Today's episode hinges upon the importance of eggs. And you, being an enthusiast, right?
Bit of an egghead.
Mm-hmm. You've been in situations where you have to wait in line for brunch or something, but you're not the type of guy to fight over an egg, are you?
I also very rarely will wait in line for anything. If the line's too long, I'm moving on. If the line, that's the words I live by. But no, I mean, you notice how whenever there's a storm in here, especially, or like a snowstorm, what's the first thing to go in the grocery stores?
They run through the dairy and the bakery.
And it's the bread, the eggs, and the milk. Mm-hmm. Food staples. And back in San Francisco, California, during the gold rush time in the early 1850s, a really, really, really important staple food, a very, very crucial source of protein during a time where that was very scarce because the gold rush brought out thousands and thousands of prospectors to San Francisco, which at the time was a relatively small city that just did not have the infrastructure or the resources to support those people.
Right, because the 49ers, as they were often called, these gold rush prospectors, were coming from across the country to gamble on the chance of striking it big by discovering a vein of gold. And as we know now, it's true that some people did find gold. Most did not. We should be very clear about that. But as Noel has begun to paint the picture for us here, what they all found was a very difficult environment to live in. You know, there were a lot of people asking for the same resources. And as we've seen in other historical instances, this triggers inflation. This triggers price gouging. The otherwise humble foodstuff known as the egg, available throughout the country everywhere else, became a relatively rare and high-priced commodity.
It's true. Like you say, you know, everyone wasn't going to strike it rich. In fact, most didn't. In an article from the San Francisco Gate by Gary Kimia, he describes this phenomenon as that there was more money to be made from, quote, mining the miners than from actual prospecting. So, you know, to fill that demand, little food huts, kind of fly-by-night operations came up overnight, and all kinds of different businesses sprung up in order to capitalize on this boom. And one thing they needed were cooking ingredients.
Right. And there's an excellent article by Emmeline Rood writing over at Time called The Worst That Can Happen When Egg Prices Get Too High. In this article, she discusses some of the specifics and nuts and bolts of this skyrocketing food situation. One of the primary commodities that shot up in value was the egg. And it rose to the price of $1 per egg in the 1850s, which is crazy expensive now. But let's consider that in our time, that's roughly the equivalent of $30 per an egg.
Man, I don't think I could ever want an egg that much.
No, I don't. You know, I don't know what I would do with it. I would feel bad eating it. I would feel like I have to put it in a like a box or a terrarium.
But I guess we have to remember here too, this was not, the price was not that way because it was necessarily a delicacy. There just weren't enough to go around. So it was a scarcity issue.
Mm-hmm. And there was still a good shipping infrastructure in place at the time. So eggs were being shipped in by the millions from across the Pacific, even all the way from the East Coast. And it still was not enough to satiate the teeming mass of people there. And that's why San Francisco eventually turned its eyes west to the islands of the Pacific, to a very specific island.
That's right. There is an island or a system of islands just about 30 miles outside of the Golden Gate in San Francisco called the Farallones. And they are actually the site of the largest colony of seabirds anywhere in the contiguous United States. And those birds are the common murres.
Yes, the common murres are the star of today's show. The islands themselves are home to a little less than 400 different species of birds. And the birds at this time were doing quite well because during the maritime fur trade, Russian seal hunters, got rid of the vast majority of the mammals that would be there, right?
That's right. But this still, to this day, these islands are home to tons of different marine creatures, like sea lions, elephant seal, which can grow to be the size of like a van, and swimming around the edges, you got great white sharks.
Yes. And whales, which I think would be so cool to see in person.
There's actually an article in the New York Times where Bonnie Sui takes a whale watching expedition out to these islands and spots all kinds of fantastic wildlife. The islands were called the Devil's Teeth back in the early 1850s by sailors. And that's because they were particularly treacherous and they caused quite a few shipwrecks. And it's true. These are very intense, jagged-looking cliffs. I think the highest point is almost 300 feet. And they were actually formed between 80 to 100 million years ago when the Pacific Plate collided with the North American Plate. And they weren't always islands. They eventually drifted and became islands because of plate tectonic activity. In fact, they were largely responsible for blocking the view of the San Francisco Harbor to Spanish galleons that would sail through there for over 200 years.
Yeah, and now, thankfully, we'll give you a spoiler alert here, friends and neighbors. Now, thankfully, the marine mammals have made a return to the island, but in the mid-1800s, this population was in serious trouble, which was good in the short term for the birds. It was literally for the birds.
Big time.
I was waiting on that one. And so, Noel, let's go back to what you mentioned specifically. We're looking at a bird called the common murre, M-U-R-R-E. It's an auk, A-U-K. This large auk sits upright on sea cliffs, and people will describe it as the northern version of a penguin.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some pretty cool info on it, courtesy of the good folks over at Audubon.org. Noel and I and our super producer, Casey Pegram. I can't believe we forgot to shout him out at the beginning.
No, it's cool. We saved it.
It's a cold open. So these birds, according to this stuff we were watching before we went into the studio today, they look kind of awkward on land. Not a pun, but it could be.
Yeah, they're sort of like these unwieldy penguin-like creatures, and they do fly pretty poorly. Mm-hmm. They're much better at swimming and diving to catch fish. And they nest on these really, really steep and slippery cliffs on the side of these islands. And it's really a thing to behold, Ben. There are thousands and thousands of them nesting in really close quarters on these super treacherous cliffs. Not a very comfortable situation at all.
Right, right. And not particularly inviting to us humans, unless we were driven there out of desperation. In these nests, most importantly, they have eggs. They typically have one egg, and the incubation period is about 28 to 37 days. After that, the young, when they're born, they leave the nest between 15 and 25 days later. The eggs themselves, however, are very interesting, and they do not look in any way related to the chicken eggs that were so common and so familiar to the San Franciscans of the time.
First of all, they're about twice as big, mm-hmm. and they are oddly pointed on one end.
Yes, they are piriform, which is the word we learned for today's episode.
Oh my gosh, I don't know that one, Ben.
It's what it sounds like on the tin. It's that slightly rounded pyramid-like top.
They look like cone heads.
Yeah,
the cone heads. That's what they look like. But they're also quite beautiful. They are speckled. They can be light blue. And apparently, some ornithologists believe that each one had a unique speckled pattern that allowed them to be identified by the parent, because they're nesting in such close quarters. Mm-hmm. If they didn't have some distinguishing factor, it might be hard for them to know which egg belonged to them.
Yeah, it looks kind of like a Jackson Pollock painting, and I think a new one on every egg. And I think you and I were both surprised when we learned that there had been intense research into the reasoning behind this egg shape and design. So originally people believed the shape of the egg was an adaptation to prevent it from rolling off the cliff.
That's right, and that sort of evolved over time. It was debunked in the mid-1900s when naturalists believed that the egg's shape would allow it to roll in a perfect little arc that would keep it from tumbling off of the cliffs, like you said. But then a British ornithologist named Tim Burkhead published a study, I believe in 2017, that sort of debunked that one. He says it's a combination of cleanliness and protection. Because the common mirrors are such horrible, horrible, ghastly flyers, they can careen into other nests. And his theory is that the shape allows it to make better contact with the ground, mm-hmm. therefore offering more protection against potential collisions.
Yeah, increasing surface area. And we should mention that this ornithologist, Tim Burkhead, has studied mirrors for 44 years.
He knows his mirrors.
He's the mirror guy. I always have so much respect for someone who has a specific area of expertise. And he's almost 50 years into the bird game, man. He also has some great points. I appreciate that you mentioned cleanliness, because as he's quoted in this article from Audubon, the other feature of mirror breeding ledges, says Burkhead, is that they are invariably filthy. Sometimes it's like going into a pigsty.
It's like a toilet. It's like a mountain toilet.
There are a lot of things, but they wouldn't be great roommates, these mirrors. He says that the guano and dirt that encrust an incubating egg can clog up the pores that allow chicks to breathe and also cause infection. And that's when he found that it wasn't just the rough shape of the egg, but it was also the concentration of pores and where they occur. The greatest concentration of pores for a mirror egg is around the egg's large, blunt end, and it's raised above the ground by that downward angle tip.
Okay, we have derailed ourselves with some really fascinating stuff about the science behind these creatures and their eggs and a little bit about these islands. But what was the deal, Ben, with the situation, the scarcity of eggs that caused folks to brave these treacherous waters and these slippery slopes to get those delectable eggs?
So this is where the entrepreneurial spirit kicks in. Six men decided to profit from these eggs that were just a little less than 30 miles off the coast. In 1851, they sailed to the Farallon Islands. They decided that they owned the islands. They gave themselves ownership.
You can do that?
You could, apparently.
I guess you just gotta, like, defend it.
Right.
Which we'll get into in a minute.
Right. They gave themselves company shares, and they started attempting to take these eggs with the intention being to sell them in San Francisco despite their strange appearance. Oh, and we almost forgot the coolest part about the eggs. The blood red yolk.
Blood red yolk, and apparently a slight fishy taste. But it hit like gangbusters, because apparently the chickens, what little there were in San Francisco, were eaten. So there were no more hens to lay eggs. So this was a really big deal. They had a source relatively close by, mm-hmm. although a treacherous trip to get there and to get him back. And the guy that headed up this expedition was a guy by the name of Doc Robinson, and he was a pharmacist. And he and his crew made this journey and described it as being a hellish experience, mm-hmm. And decided they were not going to do it again, but they would, you know, start a company and hire people to do it for them. And that was the impetus for the egg company.
Yeah, named in a burst of creativity.
It's also been called the Pacific Egg Company, mm-hmm. Inc., Pacific Egg Company Incorporated. Mm-hmm. But it was the first of its kind, and it very quickly bred kind of copycats that were like, hey, you can't own a whole island. That's not your island, and we're gonna come at you.
Right. Rival firms began to rise to the marketplace. These, at the beginning, the egg company was doing quite well. As Noel said, they were going like gangbusters. They were climbing up these stiff, sleek cliffs, and then they were getting swarmed by all the birds there. Then they would gather the freshest eggs in a really brutal way. They would stomp on the ones that were days old.
Yeah, so that they would have to lay new eggs. Because like you were saying, these birds typically only lay one egg per season. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you smash it, they're going to lay another one. My favorite part about this, and try to imagine this, folks, they had these special shirts called egg shirts with egg pockets.
Yeah.
And so you got these pictures of these guys with eggs stuffed in their shirts. And I found a picture actually from a newspaper, from a Richmond, Virginia newspaper from 1895. And it shows a man falling to his death while having one of these bizarre looking egg shirts on. He just looks totally, I don't know, kind of misshapen and bloated with eggs all the while these common mirrors are looking on completely disinterestedly.
Yet the demand alone egged them on in this dangerous mission. I do not apologize for that.
I'm going to have to. Someone, you must be stopped.
It's too late, man. I'm holding you hostage. I have all the eggs. So by the early 1860s, they did have not just some rival firms, but serious competition. And as we alluded to earlier, the egg company's claim on these islands was pretty dodgy, tentative at best, because just 4 years later, President James Buchanan had solidified the federal government's claim to the land for a lighthouse. So they were going up against the feds. And it all came to a head on a summer day in 1863.
Just to add a little point of clarity, there were kind of little zones in these islands, and some had more of the eggs than others.
True.
The northern part was considered far less productive in terms of eggs and was a lot more treacherous. And Dr. Robinson's egg company occupied the less treacherous, more productive part of the island. So there was a group of interlopers, shall we say, largely Italian and, mm-hmm. and Greek folks.
Independent Italian eggers, they were originally called.
Exactly. They were independent Italian. And there's an interesting political side note on this that we'll get to in just a sec. But they row up. Dr. Robinson's folks yell at them saying, you know, they say something like, land at your own peril or something like that, mm-hmm. to which these interlopers respond that they were going to land in spite of hell. And then they returned the next day to give that a shot.
And the paper loved this. The papers were calling it a war in earnest at the Farallones. We have a quote from here. At 7 o'clock yesterday morning, they tried to land, this being the Italians and the Greeks, but were warned off by the foreman of the egg company and five other employees. The latter say that the Italians then commenced firing on the Americans. Several volleys were exchanged. Edward Perkins, one of the Americans on shore, was shot through the stomach and died in a few minutes thereafter. A number of Italians were seen to fall into the boat simultaneously with the firing on shore. Which is strange because we can feel some racial tension or some ethnic tension that the paper is putting in there. Ultimately, two men were killed in the conflict, one on each side. So one of the egg company members and one of the Italian eggers. The leader of the independent folks, the one who most probably said we're going to land here in spite of hell,
yep.
Was ultimately convicted of murder and sent up the river to the state prison for a year.
Just a year.
Just a year, yeah. Which makes you wonder. And this, even this, did not stop the demand for these eggs, which were also, that yolk was twice the size of a chicken egg, so it was pretty nutritious.
A lot of bang for your buck, but pretty pricey, like you were saying earlier, with the inflation rate putting them in about $30 an egg. Although you could get a dozen for a dollar in certain circumstances. But because of the work that it took to get these things, and like, you know, people did fall to their deaths into the great white shark infested waters, no one was going to part with these things for any less than top dollar. There is a really fantastic comic that a writer and illustrator from San Francisco named Eva Chrysanth wrote on her blog, farallonegwar.blogspot.com. She's got all kinds. She's a really great chronicler of this whole story.
Yeah.
And she talks about that racial tension. She has a panel that describes three different men. What kind of man would risk his life for a seabird egg, she asks.
You want to read a couple?
Yeah, let's read a couple. The first one says this. It's got a picture of this man, mustachioed, fair-haired man, and this is the speech bubble. It says, "Like many other northern Italians in the years before unification, I fled the forced conscription of the Austrian army. Instead, I fought alongside Garibaldi in Brazil. Democracy, I was a fool. Now I see the democracy as just an illusion, like justice, salvation, and gold. For how many men will realize such riches? From Brazil, I took a job on a whaling ship, the most bestial work on earth besides this. And when gold was found in California, our ship came here."
And this is coming specifically from a blog in reaction to an earlier NPR piece by the Kitchen Sisters that details the war. This blog piece from August 2016 is called What NPR Left Out.
Because she was actually interviewed in that piece for 2 hours and feels like the Kitchen Sisters piece, which is really cool and richly sound designed and really, really interesting.
Yeah.
It does leave out this racial angle entirely.
Right, right. And it's a very important part of the story. So our second person says, he has a larger mustache, darker hair. He says, "I fought for Greek independence from Turkey, and we did free ourselves into hunger, chaos, and a corrupt Bavarian monarchy in Athens. If you only knew what a mess Europe is now, and all because of man. But now in this strange new land, rich in water, rich in animal life, rich in possibility, I finally feel free. Here, I dream again. Am I wrong to feel hope?" And we have one other panel here.
The last one is a clean-shaven man, this time with a nice pork pie hat kind of situation. He says that this is really sad. He says, "The tax collector in Medina tightened up its grip on my farm and my family. They finally seized the land the day after my son died of malaria. My wife went mad and stabbed the tax collector. Then she took her own life. I do not know what will happen to me in California, but I pray that it does not get worse, because trust me, things can always get worse." And what this comic and most of the content on this blog is really about is the fact that these men that were, working for the egg company in the first place, or going independent, trying to go independent and fight against the egg company and their dominance, their stranglehold over this island, they were just desperate and willing to do the work.
Yeah, that's the thing, because you will hear differing opinions from various historians and researchers on the nature of these eggmen, these eggers. As recently as 2005, an author named Susan Casey described the eggmen as mafioso in her book, The Devil's Teeth. This seems like more of a subjective belief rather than something that's backed up with primary documentation, because as Chrysanth points out, there was not a mafia presence in California for nearly a century. And in the early 1800s, most of the immigrants to San Francisco who came from Italy came from northern Italy, which did not have a mafia.
That's right. And the thing is, like, this egg war, it's not really referring to this one battle. I mean, the battle was kind of like it bubbled over and there was actual violence. But there was always little scraps periodically, and there was always that vying for the best real estate on this island, because the egg company didn't own the island.
Right. Not really. Nah. They can't go against the feds with it.
Just had the most manpower, I guess.
And to show how tense this situation was, there were also egg pirates. Literal egg pirates. There were some folks who said, you know, why should we have to go risk our lives on the slopes when we could hang out here on the water and just take eggs from boats that were on the way back to San Francisco.
I read, I'm trying to find the source. Oh, here it is. Yeah, it was in the Time piece. Apparently, one expedition during this nesting season for these birds, they would get 500,000 eggs, which just goes to show, like, how damn many of these things there were. Because, again, typically, these birds were only laying a single egg per season.
And this had an, as you might assume, detrimental effect upon the breeding population. This was not a sustainable practice over the long term.
No, the populations dwindled from hundreds of thousands of birds before the egging began in the 1850s to fewer than 30,000.
Luckily for us, this story of ridiculous history does have a happy ending because the birds are still around with the hundreds of other seabird species that continue to live and breed on the island. We're going to go ahead and tell you, it's kind of tough to get there.
It's really tough to get there, and it has been declared a National Wildlife Refuge site, and it is pretty much uninhabited, except for a small research station. And the birds are protected, and you can ask for permission to go to the island, but that is very rarely granted, apparently.
Right. You and I would definitely have to put some planning into it. You can see footage of people arriving to the island, and one of the things that struck me was after they sail out to the island, they have to get in a different boat and be lifted via crane onto the island. Crane is in a human-built crane, not a bird. That would be infinitely cooler.
That'd be cool, but completely absurd. And, you know, sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg. I can't believe – did you just Cobra Kai reference us?
I Cobra Kai'd you, sir.
So what we do also want to point out here is that despite – their success in regrowing the population and recovering the population of the common muir, the fact remains that as we record this, there are fewer common muirs on the island than there were before the gold rush more than 150 years ago.
Yeah, and there had been around 400,000 is another stat that I saw, and it dwindled down to closer to 6,000 because of this just rapacious behavior by these eggers.
And I have to say, I don't want to put you on the spot here, Noel, but it's very interesting to me that you're pro-egg because you're so anti-bird.
I am very anti-bird. I also, when I eat chicken, I don't like to think of what it used to be.
Yeah.
I do like chicken, though. Ben, do you know what actually finally put a stop to this this unchecked egging?
Well, I hope this isn't a quizster segment. I'm going to say chicken farming.
You got it. Chicken farming became a thing in nearby Petaluma and became a huge industry, and that took the pressure off for getting that sweet, sweet protein.
Thankfully, yes. And this felt like a too little, too late situation initially because, as we said, the population had dropped, but luckily the birds were able to recover. And after this titular event, this war, which lasted, historians guess, around 20 minutes, actually.
Yeah.
Still not the shortest war in history, but that's a story for a different day. After this war, the eggers continued to work on the island for another couple of decades, about 20 years, until they were finally evicted in 1881. But the trade didn't stop even then. It persisted for a number of years afterward.
Yeah, and even today, I mean, I've heard of people going, you know, they visit San Francisco or know about, like, they call summer, like, gull egg season or something like that. So you can get fresh gull eggs. It's probably super illegal. It's poaching, I think, right?
Would you have ever eaten a gull egg?
I don't know. I think the most exotic egg I've ever eaten was a quail egg.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't see why not. It just seems like they taste weird. I don't know.
If it's not an endangered species, I think egg-wise, I would generally be okay. But also, when we have been traveling, whether for work or whether for fun, anytime we're near a large coastal area, gulls are like the roughest characters you're going to meet.
Now, I was actually in San Francisco a little less than a month ago for work, and gulls, I think, are probably the source of my bird phobia. When my grandfather, when I was a kid, my grandfather would have the gulls swarm me on the beach. So when I was in San Francisco, I always kind of like, look askance. Yeah, he would throw breadcrumbs in the – I have this memory of being a little kid and seeing these things dive bombing me from the sky. And I think that is the source of my fear. But when I'm out west, I always look askance at those – creepy guys. I feel like they're always trying to come at me. They're eyeballing me from the side and looking to plan their attack.
That's a harrowing experience, man. This is the first time you told me that story. I'm glad you're okay.
It might all just be coming back to me now. Like, literally this moment, I finally see the source. It's like I'm being flooded with all this emotion and memory.
I can tell. It's written in large font on your body language, but I promise you this. Casey and I, and hopefully you as well, fellow listeners, will protect you. And will not throw bread at you.
Please don't. Ben, I really enjoyed this episode. I thought this was a really fascinating story with a lot of fun little side nuggets. So I think we can wrap it up, but I would love it if we could do a couple of listener mails.
That sounds like a great idea. You want to do one each?
That sounds good, sir. I will go first, Ben, to get mine out of the way because mine is a message of shame. J. Robert Joseph wrote in very kindly, and he mentioned this about our Ford GT40, Enzo Ferrari versus Ford the second podcast episode, and he had a little correction for me. He said, quote, "You mentioned that cars in 24-hour Le Mans went around 250 miles per hour. At that time, 1950, only one car had broken the 200 mile per hour barrier. It was the Sunbeam 1000 HP back in 1927. But until 1987, no other car hit 200 miles per hour with the Ferrari F40. The time period you mentioned in the podcast was circa 1950. At that time, the average lap times of a Le Mans car was 89 miles per hour, with the fastest laps being done at 102. Small detail, but I'm a little bit of a petrol head. Thank you." And I'm just going to read you my response that I wrote to J. Robert. "Hi there. First off, let me put on my best Homer Simpson voice when I say, no! I am admittedly, and I even admitted it on the podcast, not a petrol head and somehow got that stat utterly wrong. I'll be sure and mention it on the next one we record. Thanks for listening." And here I am doing that thing. So thank you very much for the correction. You're absolutely right. And yeah, I screwed up.
Hey, don't beat yourself up, and thanks for checking out.
I will if I want to.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to throw bread at you either way. We had another mention that in the 2016 Le Mans that we mentioned toward the end of that episode, we said Porsche placed first in its class, and Ford placed first and third in its class. So it was not all a hard luck story. But thanks so much for writing in, sir. We have one other email that fascinated all three of us, Casey, Noel, and myself. And it is from Ayumi. "Hello, I'm a big fan of the podcast. My name is Ayumi, and I'm a Japanese-American raised in the U.S., but born and currently living in Japan. I just finished listening to the CAPS episode, and I wanted to comment and share some insight into emoji. I'm an English teacher, but a believer in descriptivism over prescriptivism when it comes to language," which I love that point. I completely agree with you. Ayumi continues, "As I teach in an English school that allows non-native teachers, we all use the texting app LINE, capital L-I-N-E, which is Japanese and predominant form of texting in Asia. But on top of that, my main source of understanding emoji use actually comes from my experience with dating apps. I used a few internationally popular ones. I live relatively close to Tokyo, so I had a few observations I think you might find interesting. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to do some excerpts here. The hands folded together, these are used to mean please by Japanese people, often put at the end of the request. It's the suggested emoji when I type please into the LINE app. The eggplant emoji, which is infamous here in the States, by the way.
Oh, sure.
Was, says Ayumi, universally used by creeps outside of Japan as well as mixed Japanese people, but Japanese nationals have no understanding of the racing meaning unless they have friends overseas. Same with the peach. And she goes on to talk about how the tear or splash emoji in Japan is used when someone is feeling awkward, much like other sweat drop emoji.
That's in anime all the time, too. Whenever you see someone that's struggling with something or stressed out, they'll have little sweat lines coming out of their faces.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Ayumi ends by saying another important note, not everyone uses standard emoji anymore. For example, users of LINE will use their own emoji set called stamps or stickers. There are tons of them, and users can even purchase special large ones specific to shows and games they like. I've attached screenshots of my own app showing just the original set, which we checked out, and Ayumi ends it by saying, "Hope you have a great day. Regards." Thanks so much for writing to us. I find the evolution of language, especially in the realm of emoji, endlessly fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. And I just think, too, it's interesting that the set that comes stock on, you know, most phones, iPhones at least, are, you know, there are some characters in there that are pretty intensely Japanese, and that I am still not, like, there's a couple of food items that I don't even think I've ever seen before. One thing that's funny, and you probably experienced this too, my girlfriend has an Android and I have an iPhone. Our emoji sets do not match. When I send her something that looks a certain way for me, it does not look the same for her, and there are a few that have problematic differences.
Yes. Yeah. Agreed.
Like, there's one that's sort of the Spanish dancer lady doing, doing like a move. And on her end, it's a little boy doing like a b-boy doing hip hop dance moves, like break dancing.
It's so strange because I used to have an Android too, and I would notice this in when we were in group chats or something, or when I was texting someone, or I would receive a text and I would think, what the hell is this? Is this, what story are you telling me? I thought we were going to meet at the barbecue place.
There's another one that, like, when it comes on my end, it looks like an eye roll. And I said something to her about something that happened with my daughter that I thought was just talking about, you know, being a dad and saying something dorky. And she sent me this eye roll and I'm like, that's so mean. But it was not, that didn't look that way on her end. It looked like a wide eyed or happy face or something like that. So, you know, careful, Android versus iPhone users. You might be sending mixed messages and not even know it.
And give somebody the benefit of the doubt if they send you something that you think is crazy town.
That's true. I'll often send a screenshot of what it looks like on my phone back to her so that we're on the same page. We've kind of learned to do that.
That's a good policy. And that's where we're going to end our listener mail. But not our show. We, of course, want to thank Casey Pegram, and we want to thank Alex Williams for composing that fan favorite theme.
And regular contributor Lori L. Dove, who wrote 150 years ago, men killed for the eggs of these birds on How Stuff Works.
And most importantly, you, specifically you, not a general
me?
You. Yes, you, and you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of Ridiculous History. I really hope that you enjoyed this episode about the egg boar, because in our very next episode, we're going to be diving into another bit of food crime history.
Yeah, with the sordid tale of bootleg margarine.
I wanted to use, remember we were talking about this, I wanted to use the phrase butter smuggler just because it sounded cool.
I like it.
But it's margarine.
I know, it's okay though. You can still say it, butter comes up.
Yeah. I'm going to, spoiler, we're going to be waiting to slip that one in there. And we might even have a surprise guest. Who, you may ask, will this guest be? Well, there's one way to find out.
Yeah, just tune in. Come hang out with us. Thanks, guys.